that leads to the quantity of sales that earn the company the most money. The marketing executives may err either way. They may underprice the items, in which case they'll sell out, or they may overprice the items, in which case they'll have a warehouse full of sweatshirts. Actually, there is another option. A firm can attempt to sell the same item to different people at different prices. The fancy name is price discrimination. The next time you're on an airplane, try this experiment. Ask the person next to you how much he or she paid for the ticket. It's probably not what you paid. It may not even be close. You're sitting on the same plane, traveling to the same destination, eating the same peanuts, yet the prices you and your roommate paid for your tickets may not even have the same number of digits. The basic challenge for the airline industry is to separate business travelers who are willing to pay a great deal for a ticket from pleasure travelers who are on tighter budgets. If an airline sells every ticket at the same price, the company will leave money on the table no matter what price it chooses. A business traveler may be willing to pay $1,800 to fly a round trip from Chicago to San Francisco. Someone flying to Cousin Irv's wedding will shell out no more than $250. If the airline charges the high fare, it'll lose all of its pleasure travelers. If it charges the low fare, it'll lose all the profits that business travelers would have been willing to pay. What to do? Learn to distinguish business travelers from pleasure travelers, and then charge each of them a different fare. The airlines are pretty good at this. Why will your fare drop sharply if you stay over a Saturday night? Because Saturday night is when you're going to be dancing at Cousin Irv's wedding. Pleasure travelers usually spend the weekend at their destination, while business travelers almost never do. Buying the ticket 2 weeks ahead of time will be much, much cheaper than buying it 11 minutes before the flight leaves. Vacationers plan ahead, while business travelers tend to buy tickets at the last minute. Airlines are the most obvious example of price discrimination, but look around and you'll start to see it everywhere. Al Gore complained during the 2000 presidential campaign that his mother and his dog were taking the same arthritis medication, but that his mother paid much more for her prescription. Never mind that he made up the story after reading about the pricing disparity between humans and canines, the example is still perfect. There's nothing surprising about the fact that the same medicine will be sold to dogs and people at different prices. It's airline seats all over again. People will pay more for their own medicine than they will for their pets. So the profit-maximizing strategy is to charge one price for patients with two legs and another price for patients with four. Price discrimination will become even more prevalent as technology enables firms to gather more information about their customers. It's now possible, for example, to charge different prices to customers ordering online rather than over the phone. Or a firm can charge different prices to different online customers depending on the pattern of their past purchases. The logic behind firms like Priceline, a website where consumers bid for travel services, is that every customer could conceivably pay a different price for an airline ticket or hotel room. In an article entitled How Technology Tailors Price Tags, the Wall Street Journal noted, "Grocery stores appear to be the model of one price for all. But even today, they post one price, charge another to shoppers willing to clip coupons, and a third to those with frequent shopper cards that allow stores to collect detailed data on buying habits." What can we infer from all of this? Consumers try to make themselves as well off as possible, and firms try to maximize profits. Those are seemingly simple concepts, yet they can tell us a tremendous amount about how the world works. The market economy is a powerful force for making our lives better. The only way firms can make profits is by delivering goods that we want to buy. They create new products, everything from thermal coffee mugs to life-saving antibiotics. Or they take an existing product and make it cheaper or better. This kind of competition is fabulously good for consumers. In 1900, a 3-minute phone call from New York to Chicago cost $5.45, the equivalent of about $140 today. Now, the same call is essentially free if you have a mobile phone with unlimited minutes. Profit inspires some of our greatest work, even in areas like higher education, the arts, and medicine. How many world leaders fly to North Korea when they need open-heart surgery? At the same time, the market is immoral. Not immoral, simply amoral. The market rewards scarcity, which has no inherent relation to value. Diamonds are worth thousands of dollars a carat, while water, if you're bold enough to drink it out of the tap, is nearly free. If there were no diamonds on the planet, we'd be inconvenienced. If all the water disappeared, we'd be dead. The market does not provide goods that we need. It provides goods that we want to buy. This is a crucial distinction. Our medical system does not provide health insurance for the poor. Why? Because they can't pay for it. Our most talented doctors do provide breast enhancements and facelifts for Hollywood stars. Why? Because they can pay for it. Meanwhile, firms can make a lot of money doing nasty things. Why do European crime syndicates kidnap young girls in Eastern Europe and sell them into prostitution in wealthier countries? Because it's profitable. In fact, criminals are some of the most innovative folks around. Drug traffickers can make huge profits by transporting cocaine from where it's produced, in the jungles of South America, to where it's consumed, in the cities and towns across the United States. This is illegal, of course. U.S. authorities devote a great amount of resources to interdicting the supply of such drugs headed toward potential consumers. As with any other market, drug runners who find clever ways of eluding the authorities are rewarded with huge profits. Customs officials are pretty good at sniffing out, literally in many cases, large caches of drugs moving across the border. So drug traffickers figured out that it was easier to skip the border crossings and move their contraband across the sea and into the United States using small boats. When the U.S. Coast Guard began tracking fishing boats, drug traffickers invested in go-fast boats that could outrun the authorities. And when U.S. law enforcement adopted radar and helicopters to hunt down the speedboats, the drug runners innovated yet again, creating the trafficking equivalent of Velcro or the iPhone. Homemade submarines. In 2006, the Coast Guard stumbled across a 49-foot submarine, handmade in the jungles of Colombia, that was invisible to radar and equipped to carry 4 men and 3 tons of cocaine. In 2000, Colombian police raided a warehouse and discovered a 100-foot submarine under construction that would have been able to carry 200 tons of cocaine. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Joseph Nimitz told the New York Times, "Like any business, if you're losing more and more of your product, you try to find a different way." The market is like evolution. It's an extraordinarily powerful force that derives its strength from rewarding the swift, the strong, and the smart. That said, it would be wise to remember that two of the most beautifully adapted species on the planet are the rat and the cockroach. Our system uses prices to allocate scarce resources. Since there is a finite amount of everything worth having, the most basic function of any economic system is to decide who gets what. Who gets tickets to the Super Bowl? The people who are willing to pay the most. Who had the best seats for the Supreme Soviet Bowl in the old USSR? assuming some such event existed, the individuals chosen by the Communist Party.
Prices had nothing to do with it.
If a Moscow butcher received a new shipment of pork, he slapped on the official state price for pork. And if that price was low enough that he had more customers than pork chops, he didn't raise the price to earn some extra cash. He merely sold the chops to the first people in line. Those at the end of the line were out of luck. Capitalism and communism both ration goods. We do it with prices. The Soviets did it by waiting in line. Of course, the communists had many black markets. It's quite likely that the butcher sold extra pork chops illegally out the back door of his shop. Because we use price to allocate goods, most markets are self-correcting. Periodically, the oil ministers from the OPEC nations will meet in an exotic locale and agree to limit the global production of oil. Several things happen shortly thereafter. 1. Oil and gas prices start to go up. And 2. Politicians begin falling all over themselves with ideas, mostly bad, for intervening in the oil market. But high prices are like a fever. They are both a symptom and a potential cure. While politicians are puffing away on the House floor, some other crucial things start to happen. We drive less. We get one heating bill and decide to insulate the attic. We go to the Ford showroom and walk past the expeditions to the escorts. When gas prices approached $4 a gallon in 2008, the rapid response of American consumers surprised even economists. Americans began buying smaller cars. SUV sales plunged while subcompact sales rose. We drove fewer total miles, the first monthly drop in 30 years. We climbed on public buses and trains, often for the first time. Transit ridership was higher in 2008 than at any time since the creation of the interstate highway system 5 decades earlier. Not all such behavioral changes were healthy. Many consumers switched from cars to motorcycles, which are more fuel-efficient, but also more dangerous. After falling steadily for years, the number of U.S. motorcycle deaths began to rise in the mid-1990s, just as gas prices began to climb. A study in the American Journal of Public Health estimated that every $1 increase in the price of gasoline is associated with an additional 1,500 motorcycle deaths annually. High oil prices cause things to start happening on the supply side, too. Oil producers outside of OPEC start pumping more oil to take advantage of the high price. Indeed, the OPEC countries usually begin cheating on their own production quotas. Domestic oil companies begin pumping oil from wells that were not economical when the price of petroleum was low. Meanwhile, a lot of very smart people begin working more seriously on finding and commercializing alternative sources of energy. The price of oil and gasoline begins to drift down as supply rises and demand falls. If we fix prices in a market system, private firms will find some other way to compete. Consumers often look back nostalgically at the early days of airplane travel, when the food was good, the seats were bigger, and people dressed up when they traveled. This is not just nostalgia speaking. The quality of coach air travel has fallen sharply. But the price of air travel has fallen even faster. Prior to 1978, airline fares were fixed by the government. Every flight from Denver to Chicago cost the same, but American and United were still competing for customers. They used quality to distinguish themselves. When the industry was deregulated, price became the primary margin for competition, presumably because that is what consumers care more about. Since then, everything related to being in or near an airplane has become less pleasant. But the average fare, adjusted for inflation, has fallen by nearly half. In 1995, I was traveling across South Africa and I was struck by the remarkable service at the gas stations along the way. The attendants, dressed in sharp uniforms, often with bow ties, would scurry out to fill the tank, check the oil, and wipe the windshield. The bathrooms were spotless, a far cry from some of the scary things I've seen driving across the USA. Was there some special service station mentality in South Africa? No. The price of gasoline was fixed by the government. So service stations, which were still private firms, resorted to bow ties and clean bathrooms to attract customers. Every market transaction makes all parties better off. Firms are acting in their own best interests, and so are consumers. This is a simple idea that has enormous power. Consider an inflammatory example. The problem with Asian sweatshops is that there are not enough of them. Adult workers take jobs in these unpleasant, low-wage manufacturing facilities voluntarily. I am not writing about forced labor or child labor, both of which are different cases. So one of two things must be true. Either one, workers take unpleasant jobs in sweatshops because it's the best employment option they have. Or two, Asian sweatshop workers are persons of weak intellect who have many more attractive job offers but choose to work in sweatshops instead. Most arguments against globalization implicitly assume number two. The protesters smashing windows in Seattle were trying to make the case that workers in the developing world would be better off if we curtailed international trade, thereby closing down the sweatshops that churn out shoes and handbags for those of us in the developed world. But how exactly does that make workers in poor countries better off? It does not create any new opportunities. The only way it could possibly improve social welfare is if fired sweatshop workers take new, better jobs, opportunities they presumably ignored when they went to work in a sweatshop. When was the last time a plant closing in the United States was hailed as good news for its workers? Sweatshops are nasty places by Western standards. And yes, one might argue that Nike should pay its foreign workers better wages out of sheer altruism. But they are a symptom of poverty, not a cause. Nike pays a typical worker in one of its Vietnamese factories roughly $600 a year. That is a pathetic amount of money. It also happens to be twice an average Vietnamese worker's annual income. Indeed, sweatshops played an important role in the development of countries like South Korea and Taiwan, as we'll explore in Chapter 12. Given that economics is built upon the assumption that humans act consistently in ways that make themselves better off, one might reasonably ask, are we really that rational? Not always, it turns out. One of the fiercest assaults on the notion of strict rationality comes from a seemingly silly observation. Economist Richard Thaler hosted a dinner party years ago, at which he served a bowl of cashews before the meal. He noticed that his guests were wolfing down the nuts at such a pace that they would likely spoil their appetite for dinner. So Thaler took the bowl of nuts away, at which point his guests thanked him. Believe it or not, this little vignette exposes a fault in the basic tenets of microeconomics. In theory, it should never be possible to make rational individuals better off by denying them some option. People who don't want to eat too many cashews should just stop eating cashews. But they don't. And that finding turns out to have implications far beyond salted nuts. For example, if humans lack the self-discipline to do things that they know will make themselves better off in the long run, for example, lose weight, stop smoking, or save for retirement, then society could conceivably make them better off by helping or coercing them to do things they otherwise would not or could not do. The public policy equivalent of taking the cashew bowl away. The field of behavioral economics has evolved as a marriage between psychology and economics that offers sophisticated insight into how humans really make decisions. Daniel Kahneman, a professor in both psychology and public affairs at Princeton, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002 for his studies of decision-making under uncertainty, and in particular, how human decisions may systematically depart from those predicted by standard economic theory. Kahneman and others have advanced the concept of bounded rationality, which suggests that most of us make decisions using intuition or rules of thumb, kind of like looking at the sky to determine if it will rain, rather than spending hours poring over weather forecasts. Most of the time, this works just fine. Sometimes it doesn't. The behavioral economists study ways in which these rules of thumb may lead us to do things that diminish our utility in the long run. For example, individuals don't always have a particularly refined sense of risk and probability. This point was brought home to me recently as I admired a large Harley-Davidson motorcycle parked on a sidewalk in New Hampshire, a state that does not require motorcycle helmets. The owner ambled up and said, "Do you want to buy it?" I replied that motorcycles are a little too dangerous for me, to which he exclaimed, "You're willing to fly in a plane, aren't you?" In fact, riding a motorcycle is 2,000 times more dangerous than flying for every kilometer traveled. That's not an entirely fair comparison, since motorcycle trips tend to be much shorter. Still, any given motorcycle journey, regardless of length, is 14 times more likely to end in death than any trip by plane. Conventional economics makes clear that some people will ride motorcycles, with or without helmets, because the utility they get from going fast on a two-wheeler outweighs the risks they incur in the process. That's perfectly rational. But if the person making that decision doesn't understand the true risk involved, then it may not be a rational trade-off after all. Behavioral economics has developed a catalog of these kinds of potential errors, many of which are an obvious part of everyday life. Many of us don't have all the self-control that we'd like. 80% of American smokers say they want to quit. Most of them don't. Reports from inside the White House suggested that President Obama was still trying to kick the habit even after moving into the Oval Office. Some very prominent economists, including one Nobel Prize winner, have argued for decades that there is such a thing as rational addiction, meaning that individuals will take into account the likelihood of addiction and all its future costs when buying that first pack of Camels. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who has studied smoking behavior extensively, thinks that is nonsense. He argues that consumers don't rationally weigh the benefits of smoking enjoyment against future health risks and other costs, as the standard economic model assumes. Gruber writes, "The model is predicated on a description of the smoking decision that is at odds with laboratory evidence, the behavior of smokers, econometric, statistical analysis, and common sense." We may also lack the basic knowledge necessary to make sensible decisions in some situations. Anna Maria Lusardi of Dartmouth College and Olivia Mitchell of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania surveyed a large sample of Americans over the age of 50 to gauge their financial literacy. Only a third could do simple interest rate calculations. Most did not understand the concept of investment diversification. If you don't know what that means either, you will after reading Chapter 7. Based on her research, Professor Lusardi has concluded that financial illiteracy is widespread. These are not merely esoteric fun facts that pipe-smoking academics like to kick around in the faculty lounge. Bad decisions can have bad outcomes for all of us. The global financial crisis arguably has its roots in irrational behavior. One of our behavioral rules of thumb as humans is to see patterns in what is really randomness. As a result, we assume that whatever is happening now will continue to happen in the future, even when data, probability, or basic analysis suggest the contrary. A coin that comes up heads 4 times in a row is lucky. A basketball player who has hit 3 shots in a row has a hot hand. A team of cognitive psychologists made one of the enduring contributions to this field by disproving the hot hand in basketball using NBA data and by conducting experiments with the Cornell varsity men's and women's basketball teams. This is the rare academic paper that includes interviews with the Philadelphia 76ers. 91% of basketball fans believe that a player has a better chance of making a shot after having just made his last 2 or 3 shots than he does after having just missed his last 2 or 3 shots. In fact, there is no evidence that a player's chances of making a shot are greater after making a previous shot, not with field goals for the 76ers, not with free throws for the Boston Celtics, and not when Cornell players shot baskets as part of a controlled experiment. Basketball fans are surprised by that, just as many homeowners were surprised in 2006 when real estate prices stopped going up. Lots of people had borrowed a lot of money on the assumption that what goes up must keep going up. The result has been a wave of foreclosures with devastating ripple effects throughout the global economy, which is a heck of a lot more significant than eating too many cashews. Chapter 3 discusses what, if anything, public policy ought to do about our irrational tendencies. As John F. Kennedy famously remarked, "Life is not fair." Neither is capitalism in some important respects. Is it a good system? I'll argue that a market economy is to economics what democracy is to government, a decent, if flawed, choice among many bad alternatives. Markets are consistent with our views of individual liberty. We may disagree over whether or not the government should compel us to wear motorcycle helmets, but most of us agree that the state should not tell us where to live, what to do for a living, or how to spend our money. True, there is no way to rationalize spending money on a birthday cake for my dog when the same money could have vaccinated several African children. But any system that forces me to spend money on vaccines instead of doggy birthday cakes can only be held together by oppression. The communist governments of the 20th century controlled their economies by controlling their citizens' lives. They often wrecked both in the process. During the 20th century, communist governments killed some 100 million of their own people in peacetime, either by repression or by famine. Markets are consistent with human nature and therefore wildly successful at motivating us to reach our potential. I'm writing this book because I love to write. I'm writing this book because I believe that economics will be interesting to lay readers. And I'm writing this book because I really want a summer home in New Hampshire. We work harder when we benefit directly from our work, and that hard work often yields significant social gains. Last, and most important, we can and should use government to modify markets in all kinds of ways. The economic battle of the 20th century was between capitalism and communism. Capitalism won. Even my leftist brother-in-law doesn't believe in collective farming or government-owned steel mills, though he did once say that he'd like to see a healthcare system modeled after the U.S. Post Office. On the other hand, reasonable people can disagree sharply over when and how the government should involve itself in a market economy, or what kind of safety net we should offer to those whom capitalism treats badly. The economic battles of the 21st century will be over how unfettered our markets should be. Chapter 2. Incentives matter. Why you might be able to save your face by cutting off your nose, if you are a black rhinoceros. The black rhinoceros is one of the most endangered species on the planet. Some 4,000 of them roam southern Africa, down from about 65,000 in 1970. This is an ecological disaster in the making. It's also a situation in which basic economics can tell us why the species is in such trouble, and perhaps even what we can do about it. Why do people kill black rhinos? For the same reason they sell drugs or cheat on their taxes. Because they can make a lot of money relative to the risk of getting caught. In many Asian countries, the horn of the black rhino is believed to be a powerful aphrodisiac and fever reducer. It's also used to make the handles on traditional Yemenese daggers. As a result, a single rhino horn can fetch $30,000 on the black market, a princely sum in countries where per capita income is around $1,000 a year and falling. In other words, the black rhino is worth far more dead than alive to the people of impoverished southern Africa. Sadly, this is a market that does not naturally correct itself. Unlike automobiles or personal computers, firms can't produce new black rhinos as they see the supply dwindling. Indeed, quite the opposite force is at work. As the black rhino becomes more and more imperiled, the black market price for rhino horn rises, providing even more incentive for poachers to hunt down the remaining animals. This vicious circle is compounded by another aspect of the situation that is common to many environmental challenges. Most black rhinos are communal property rather than private property. That may sound wonderful. In fact, it creates more conservation problems than it solves. Imagine that all the black rhinos were in the hands of a single avaricious rancher who had no qualms about making rhino horns into Yemenese daggers. This rancher has not a single environmental bone in his body. Indeed, he's so mean and selfish that sometimes he kicks his dog just because it gives him utility. Would this ogre of a rhino rancher have let his herd fall from 65,000 to 4,000 in 30 years? Never. He would have bred and protected the animals so that he would always have a large supply of horns to ship off to market, much as cattle ranchers manage their herds. This has nothing to do with altruism. It has everything to do with maximizing the value of a scarce resource. Communal resources, on the other hand, present some unique problems. First, the villagers who live in close proximity to these majestic animals usually derive no benefit from having them around. To the contrary, large animals like rhinos and elephants can cause massive damage to crops. To put yourself in the shoes of local villagers, imagine that the people of Africa suddenly took a keen interest in the future of the North American brown rat, and that a crucial piece of the conservation strategy involved letting these creatures live and breed in your house. Further imagine that a poacher came along and offered you cash to show him where the rats were nesting in your basement. True, millions of people around the world derive utility from conserving species like the black rhino or the mountain gorilla, but that can actually be a part of the problem. It's easy to be a free rider and let someone else or some other organization do the work. Last year, how much time and money did you contribute to preserving endangered species? Tour and safari operators, who do make a lot of money by bringing wealthy tourists to see rare wildlife, face a similar free rider problem. If one tour company invests heavily in conservation, other tour companies that have made no such investment still enjoy all the benefits of the rhinos that have been saved. So the firm that spends money on conservation actually suffers a cost disadvantage in the market. Their tours will have to be more expensive, or they'll have to accept a lower profit margin in order to recoup their conservation investment. Obviously, there's a role for government here. But the governments in sub-Saharan Africa are low on resources at best, and corrupt and dysfunctional at worst. The one party who has a clear and powerful incentive is the poacher, who makes a king's ransom by hunting down the remaining rhinos, killing them, and then sawing off their horns. This is pretty depressing stuff. But economics also offers at least some insight into how the black rhino and other endangered species can be saved. An effective conservation strategy must properly align the incentives of the people who live in or near the black rhino's natural habitat. Translation: give local people some reason to want the animals alive rather than dead. This is the premise of the budding ecotourism industry. If tourists are willing to pay great amounts of money to spot and photograph black rhinos, and more important, if local citizens somehow share the profits from this tourism, then the local population has a large incentive to keep such animals alive. This has worked in places like Costa Rica, a country that's protected its rainforests and other ecological features by setting aside more than 25% of the country as national parks. Tourism currently generates over $1 billion in annual revenue, accounting for 11% of the national income. Sadly, this process is working in reverse at the moment with the mountain gorilla, another seriously endangered species, made famous by Diane Fossey, author of Gorillas in the Mist. It's estimated that only 620 mountain gorillas are left in the dense jungles of East Africa. But the countries that make up this region, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Congo, are embroiled in a series of civil wars that have devastated the tourism trade. In the past, local inhabitants have preserved the gorilla's habitat not because they have any great respect for the mountain gorilla, but because they can make more money from tourists than they can by chopping down the forests that make up the gorilla's habitat. That has changed as the violence in the region grinds on. One local man told the New York Times, "The gorillas are important when they bring in tourists. If not, they are not. If the tourists don't come, we will try our luck in the forest. Before this, we were good timber cutters." Meanwhile, conservation officials are experimenting with another idea that's about as basic as economics can be. Black rhinos are killed because their horns fetch a princely sum. If there is no horn, then presumably there is no reason to poach the animals. Thus, some conservation officials have begun to capture black rhinos, saw off their horns, and then release the animals back into the wild. The rhinos are left mildly disadvantaged relative to some of their predators, but they're less likely to be hunted down by their most deadly enemy, man. Has it worked? The evidence is mixed. In some cases, poachers have continued to kill dehorned rhinos for a number of possible reasons. Killing the animals without horns saves the poachers from wasting time tracking the same animal again. Also, there is some money to be made from removing and selling even the stump of the horn. And sadly, dead rhinos, even without horns, make the species more endangered, which drives up the value of existing horn stocks. All of this ignores the demand side of the equation. Should we allow trade in products made from endangered species? Most would say no. Making rhino horn daggers illegal in countries like the United States lowers the overall demand, which diminishes the incentive for poachers to hunt down the animals. At the same time, there's a credible dissenting view. Some conservation officials argue that selling a limited amount of rhino horn, or ivory in the case of elephants, that has been legally stockpiled would have two beneficial effects. First, it would raise money to help strapped governments pay for anti-poaching efforts. Second, it would lower the market price for these illicit items, and therefore diminish the incentive to poach the animals. As with any complex policy issue, there is no right answer. But there are some ways of approaching the problem that are more fruitful than others. The point is that protecting the black rhino is at least as much about economics as it is about science. We know how the black rhino breeds, what it eats, where it lives. What we need to figure out is how to stop human beings from shooting them. That requires an understanding of how humans behave, not black rhinos. Incentives matter. When we're paid on commission, we work harder. If the price of gasoline goes up, we drive less. If my 3-year-old daughter learns that she'll get an Oreo if she cries while I'm talking on the phone, then she'll cry while I'm talking on the phone. This was one of Adam Smith's insights in The Wealth of Nations. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from the regard to their own interest. Bill Gates did not drop out of Harvard to join the Peace Corps. He dropped out to found Microsoft, which made him one of the richest men on the planet, and launched the personal computer revolution in the process, making all of us better off too. Self-interest makes the world go around, a point that seems so obvious as to be silly. Yet it's routinely ignored. The old slogan, "From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs," made a wonderful folk song. As an economic system, it has led to everything from inefficiency to mass starvation. In any system that does not rely on markets, personal incentives are usually divorced from productivity. Firms and workers are not rewarded for innovation and hard work, nor are they punished for sloth and inefficiency. How bad can it get? Economists reckon that by the time the Berlin Wall crumbled, some East German car factories were actually destroying value. Because the manufacturing process was so inefficient and the end product was so shoddy, the plants were producing cars worth less than the inputs used to make them. Basically, they took perfectly good steel and ruined it. These kinds of inefficiencies can also exist in nominally capitalist countries where large sectors of the economy are owned and operated by the state, such as India. By 1991, the Hindustan Fertilizer Corporation had been up and running for 12 years. Every day, 1,200 employees reported to work with the avowed goal of producing fertilizer. There was just one small complication. The plant had never actually produced any saleable fertilizer. None. Government bureaucrats ran the plant using public funds. The machinery that was installed never worked properly. Nevertheless, 1,200 workers came to work every day, and the government continued to pay their salaries. The entire enterprise was an industrial charade. It limped along because there was no mechanism to force it to shut down. When government is bankrolling the business, there is no need to produce something and then sell it for more than it costs to make. These examples seem funny in their own way, but they aren't. Right now, the North Korean economy is in such shambles that the country cannot feed itself, nor does it produce anything valuable enough to trade to the outside world in exchange for significant quantities of food. The nation is on the brink of famine, according to diplomats, United Nations officials, and other observers. This mass starvation would be a tragic repeat of the 1990s, when famine killed something on the order of 1 million people and left 60% of North Korean children malnourished. Journalists describe starving people eating grass and scouring railroad tracks for bits of coal or food that may have fallen from passing trains. In the United States, there's a great deal of hand-wringing about two energy-related issues, our dependence on foreign oil and the environmental impact of CO2 emissions. To economists, the fix for these interrelated issues is as close to a no-brainer as we ever get. Make carbon-based energy more expensive. If it costs more, we'll use less, and therefore pollute less, too. I have powerful childhood memories of my father, who has no great affection for the environment but could squeeze a nickel out of a stone, stalking around the house, closing the closet doors, and telling us that he was not paying to air condition our closets. Meanwhile, American public education operates a lot more like North Korea than Silicon Valley. I will not wade into the school voucher debate, but I will discuss one striking phenomenon related to incentives in education that I've written about for The Economist. The pay of American teachers is not linked in any way to performance. Teachers' unions have consistently opposed any kind of merit pay. Instead, Salaries in nearly every public school district in the country are determined by a rigid formula based on experience and years of schooling, factors that researchers have found to be generally unrelated to performance in the classroom. This uniform pay scale creates a set of incentives that economists refer to as adverse selection. Since the most talented teachers are also likely to be good at other professions, they have a strong incentive to leave education for jobs in which pay is more closely linked to productivity. For the least talented, the incentives are just the opposite. The theory is interesting. The data are amazing. When test scores are used as a proxy for ability, the brightest individuals shun the teaching profession at every juncture. The brightest students are the least likely to choose education as a college major. Among students who do major in education, those with higher test scores are less likely to become teachers. And among individuals who enter teaching, those with the highest test scores are the most likely to leave the profession early. None of this proves that America's teachers are being paid enough. Many of them are not, especially those gifted individuals who stay in the profession because they love it. But the general problem remains. Any system that pays all teachers the same provides a strong incentive for the most talented among them to look for work elsewhere. Human beings are complex creatures who are going to do whatever it takes to make themselves as well off as possible. Sometimes it's easy to predict how that will unfold. Sometimes it's enormously complex. Economists often speak of perverse incentives, which are the inadvertent incentives that can be created when we set out to do something completely different. In policy circles, this is sometimes called the law of unintended consequences. Consider a well-intentioned proposal to require that all infants and small children be restrained in car seats while flying on commercial airlines. During the Clinton administration, FAA Administrator Jane Garvey told a safety conference that her agency was committed to ensuring that children are accorded the same level of safety in aircraft as are adults. James Hall, chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board at the time, lamented that luggage had to be stowed for takeoff while the most precious cargo on that aircraft, infants and toddlers, were left unrestrained. Garvey and Hall cited several cases in which infants might have survived crashes had they been restrained. Thus, requiring car seats for children on planes would prevent injuries and save lives. Or would it? Using a car seat requires that a family buy an extra seat on the plane, which dramatically increases the cost of flying. Airlines no longer offer significant children's discounts. A seat is a seat, and it's likely to cost at least several $100. As a result, some families will choose to drive rather than fly. Yet driving, even with a car seat, is dramatically more dangerous than flying. As a result, requiring car seats on planes might result in more injuries and deaths to children and adults, not fewer. Consider another example in which good intentions led to a bad outcome because the incentives were not fully anticipated. Mexico City is one of the most polluted cities in the world. The foul air trapped over the city by the surrounding mountains and volcanoes has been described by the New York Times as a grayish-yellow pudding of pollutants. Beginning in 1989, the government launched a program to fight this pollution, much of which is caused by auto and truck emissions. A new law required that all cars stay off the streets one day a week on a rotating basis. For example, cars with certain license plate numbers could not be driven on Tuesday. The logic of the plan was straightforward. Fewer cars on the road would lead to less air pollution. So, what really happened? As would be expected, many people did not like the inconvenience of having their driving days limited. They reacted in a way that analysts might have predicted but did not. Families who could afford a second car bought one, or simply kept their old car when buying a new one, so that they would always have one car that could be driven on any given day. This proved to be worse for emissions than no policy at all, since the proportion of old cars on the road went up, and old cars are dirtier than new cars. The net effect of the policy change was to put more polluting cars on the road, not fewer. Subsequent studies found that overall gas consumption had increased, and air quality did not improve at all. The policy was later dropped in favor of a mandatory emissions test. Good policy uses incentives to some positive end. London has dealt with its traffic congestion problems by applying the logic of the market. It raised the cost of driving during the hours of peak demand. Beginning in 2003, the City of London began charging a £5 or $8 congestion fee for all drivers entering an 8-square-mile section of the central city between 7 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. In 2005, the congestion charge was raised to £8 or $13, and in 2007, the size of the zone for which the fee must be paid was expanded. Drivers are responsible for paying the charge by phone, internet, or in selected retail shops. Video cameras were installed in some 700 locations to scan license plates and match the data against records of motorists who have paid the charge. Motorists caught driving in central London without paying the fee are fined £80, or $130. The plan was designed to take advantage of one of the most basic features of markets. Raising prices reduces demand. Raising the cost of driving discourages some drivers and improves the flow of traffic. Experts also predicted an increase in the use of public transit, both because it's a cheap alternative to driving, but also because buses would be able to move more quickly through central London. Faster trips lower the opportunity cost of taking public transit. Within a month, the results were striking. Traffic fell 20%. Settling after several years at 15% lower. Average speed in the congestion zone doubled. Bus delays were cut in half, and the number of bus passengers climbed 14%. The only unpleasant surprise was that the program had such a significant deterrent effect on car traffic that revenues from the fee were lower than expected. Retailers have also complained that the fee discourages shoppers from visiting central London. Good policy uses incentives to channel behavior towards some desired outcome. Bad policy either ignores incentives or fails to anticipate how rational individuals might change their behavior to avoid being penalized. The wonder of the private sector, of course, is that incentives magically align themselves in a way that makes everyone better off, right? Well, not exactly. From top to bottom, corporate America is a cesspool of competing and misaligned incentives. Have you ever seen some variation of the sign near the cash register at a fast food restaurant that says, "Your meal is free if you don't get a receipt. Please see a manager." Does Burger King have a passionate interest in providing a receipt so that your family bookkeeping will be complete? Of course not. Burger King doesn't want its employees stealing. And the only way employees can steal without getting caught is by performing transactions without recording them on the cash register, selling you a burger and fries without issuing a receipt and then pocketing the cash. This is what economists call a principal-agent problem. The principal, Burger King, employs an agent, the cashier, who has an incentive to do a lot of things that are not necessarily in the best interest of the firm. Burger King can either spend a lot of time and money monitoring its employees for theft, or it can provide an incentive for you to do it for them. That little sign by the cash register is an ingenious management tool. Principal-agent problems are as much a problem at the top of corporate America as they are at the bottom, in large part because the agents who run America's large corporations, CEOs and other top executives, are not necessarily the principals who own those companies, the shareholders. I own shares in Starbucks, but I don't even know the CEO's name. How can I be sure that he, or she, is acting in my best interest? Indeed, there's ample evidence to suggest that corporate managers are no different from Burger King cashiers. They have some incentives that are not always in the best interest of the firm. They may steal from the cash register figuratively by showering themselves with private jets and country club memberships. Or they may make strategic decisions from which they benefit but shareholders do not. For example, a shocking 2/3 of all corporate mergers do not add value to the merged firms, and 1/3 of them leave shareholders worse off. Why would very smart CEOs engage so often in behavior that seems to make little financial sense? One partial answer, economists have argued, is that CEOs benefit from mergers even when shareholders are left with losses. A CEO draws a lot of attention to himself by engineering a complex corporate transaction. He's left running a bigger company, which is almost always more prestigious, even if the new entity is less profitable than the merged companies were when they were on their own. Big companies have big offices, big salaries, and big airplanes. On the other hand, some mergers and takeovers make perfect strategic sense. As an uninformed shareholder with a large financial stake in the company, how do I tell the difference? If I don't even know the name of the CEO of Starbucks, how can I be sure that she, or he, is not spending the bulk of her day chasing attractive secretaries around her office? Hell, this is harder than being a manager at Burger King. For a time, clever economists believed that stock options were the answer. They were supposed to be the CEO equivalent of the sign near the cash register asking if you received your receipt. Most American CEOs and other important executives receive a large share of their compensation in the form of stock options. These options enable the recipient to purchase the company's stock in the future at some predetermined price, say $10. If the company is highly profitable and the stock does well, climbing to, say, $57, then those stock options are very valuable. It's good to be able to buy something for $10 when it's selling on the open market for $57. On the other hand, if the company's stock falls to $7, the options are worthless. There's no point in buying something for $10 when you can buy it on the open market for $3 less. The point of this compensation scheme is to align the incentives of the CEO with the interests of the shareholders. If the share price goes up, the CEO gets rich, but the shareholders do well too. It turns out that wily CEOs can find ways to abuse the options game, just as cashiers can find new ways to steal from the register. Before the first edition of this book came out, I asked Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, to give it a read, since he had been a professor of mine. Volcker read the book. He liked the book. But, he said, that I should have not written admiringly about stock options as a tool for aligning the interests of shareholders and management because they are an instrument of the devil. Paul Volcker was right. I was wrong. The potential problem with options is that executives can do things to goose the firm's stock in the short run that are bad or disastrous for the company in the long run. After the CEO has sold tens of thousands of options for an astronomical profit. Michael Jensen, a Harvard Business School professor who has spent his career on issues related to management incentives, is even harsher than Paul Volcker. He describes options as managerial heroin because they create an incentive for managers to seek short-term highs while doing enormous long-term damage. Studies have found that companies with large options grants are more likely to engage in accounting fraud and more likely to default on their debt. Meanwhile, CEOs, with or without options, have their own monitoring headaches. Investment banks like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were literally destroyed by employees who took huge risks at the firm's expense. This is a crucial link in the chain of causality for the financial crisis. Wall Street is where a bad problem became disastrous. Banks across the country could afford to feed the real estate bubble with reckless loans because they could quickly bundle these loans together or securitize them and sell them off to investors. A bank takes your mortgage, bundles it together with my mortgage, and lots of others, and then sells the package off to some party willing to pay cash now in exchange for a future stream of income, our monthly mortgage payments. This is not inherently a bad thing when done responsibly. The bank gets its capital